Zoom. Shelley B. Shelley, always a pleasure and always a joy to work with you.
Thank you so much, DeMay, and I'm looking forward to more and more opportunities.
Oh.
And good luck with even more pandemic recordings. Yay!
We always have Zoom, Shelley.
Right?
That's it for Stage and Studio. Hear the show again at stageandstudio.org or kboo.fm/stageandstudio. Again, I have the GoFundMe link on both those pages. And you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, like us on facebook.com/stage, the letter N, studio. And so I'm going out, Shelley. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Till next time, I'm DeMay Roberts. I'm going to go out with some music by David Arnett Cherry at davidarnettcherry.com.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you are listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are the authors Dr. Christopher Brown and Dr. Jean-Pierre Isbouts. They are the co-authors of the new book, The Dali Legacy, subtitled How an Eccentric Genius Changed the Art World and Created a Lasting Legacy. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, guys.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
Just tell us where you are right now. I'm in Portland, Oregon. Where are you?
Jean-Pierre Isabouts. I'm in Santa Monica, California, where the sun is shining.
And I'm Christopher Brown, and I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the sun is also shining here.
My latest inspiration of Dali was, I was at a conference in St. Petersburg a few years back for journalism, and we took a trip to the Dali Museum there. It's set up so beautifully. It's so many big spaces dedicated to his masterpieces, these masterworks that he spent years on. Then this book is particularly interesting to me because it talks about Dali's classical influence, and then it gives a lot of context for him socially. So would one of you just speak about the social context first?
Yeah, and I would like to reinforce what you just said, Joseph, because, you know, many modern artists, particularly European modern artists, tend to have their residence, you know, their main museums in Europe. And there is certainly a wonderful Dali Museum in Figueres in Spain. But we in the United States are very fortunate to have a major museum dedicated to a European 20th century artist in the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg. So if you haven't been there yet, I would urge your listeners, when you are in Florida, just to not go to Disney World necessarily, but to visit the Dali Museum, which is an incredible experience. And so what Chris and I tried to do with this book, The Dali Legacy, was to place the artist in his context, historically, socially, politically, culturally. So often we feel that art historians get so obsessed with their subject that they only are focused on the creative development of a particular artist rather than the environment that obviously informed and shaped the development of his art. And that's what we try to do with this book.
What one thing that impressed me about the museum was, you know, they told us it was built to withstand a hurricane. It's all concrete and steel. And that's because the people who donated the art, his great patrons, was this couple from, were they from Philadelphia?
Yeah, I believe so. Mm-hmm.
So just to explain how Dali's American presence is, he came here during the Second World War and he was kind of adopted by these two collectors and they kind of kept his American presence alive and, you know, encouraged him in his kind of his business side throughout the kind of second half of his career or two thirds of his career.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that, that America had a major impact in the development of Dali as the artist that we recognize today and on various levels. He came to the United States before World War II when a New York gallery exhibited his art in the late 1930s. It was almost an instant success and provided him with the financial security that so far he had not been able to achieve in his native Spain or in France, particularly in Paris, where, of course, he developed his surrealism and was in close contact with the surrealist group. And that also explains his idea of turning himself into a brand. I mean, with his eccentric behavior, his pronouncements like, you know, every morning I wake up with a delicious idea that I am Dali, you know, in Europe, that type of eccentricism simply wasn't tolerated. You know, you were, and I can say that because I'm a European myself. I'm a product of a European university. You were judged on the merits of your art. And by going into these bizarre behavioral traits, you would just really only invite criticism. In the United States, he found it was the exact opposite. The minute he came off the boat, there would be photographers flashing away, and he would be prompted to do these hijinks that simply no European would accept. But in America, they lapped it up. He was this really this great provocateur, this bohemian, this nonconformista, which is exactly their stereotype of the crazy European modern artist. And so he really catered to that. And then, so in many ways, we could say that America shaped Dali, not only in terms of his art through the patronage that you mentioned and the success through New York art galleries, but also in terms of his persona and his development of an icon. Chris, would you agree?
Yes, this is Dr. Brown, and I 100% agree. But I will say that first painting that really made him famous in the U.S. and actually throughout the world, but specifically in New York, was called The Persistence of Memory, which are the dripping clocks in the desert scene. And, you know, there were three major donors, I would say, to Dali in his American years, of which he spent about half of his life in America and half of his life in Europe. And that would be Billy Rose, and that was mainly for theater and on Broadway. It would then be the Reynolds Morse family, Mr. Morse and his wife, which is the majority of the masterpieces in the Dali Museum are Reynolds Morse. And then Chester Dale, a little bit later in his more religious years, was a huge patron. And with those three people alone in America, they really provided him a very nice lifestyle. They allowed for these families to be able to show the works, not only on Broadway, but in the United States and in a museum, which was initially set up in Ohio, but then moved by Reynolds Morse down to the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg.
It seems like he's, like a lot of young artists, his influences were all over the place. It took a while for him to crystallize into surrealism as we know it. So what was he doing in the early days as a young man?
Well, it's very important for your audience to realize that, you know, we call him a Spanish artist. Today, we would not say that anymore. He was from Catalonia. He was Catalan. And as recent news reports suggest, Catalonia is trying very, very hard to become independent of the Spanish monarchy because culturally, linguistically, Catalonia has always been very different from Castilian Spain. It was a region and still is a region right next to the border with France. So it's always been a little bit more French than Spanish in outlook, their language, Catalan. is permeated with French expressions. Unlike the Basque region, which is to the west of Catalonia, it really feels itself very different from Spain. In fact, some critics suggest that when Dali painted the Discovery of America, which is that huge canvas that you can see in the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, it was prompted by the fact that some scholars at the time claimed that Columbus was not Italian. He was Catalan. So it's really the Catalan who discovered America, so to speak. Chris and I are very careful to emphasize that Dali was not a political figure. He never did have a strong political allegiance. In the beginning, he sympathized with the socialists, particularly in the years running up to the Spanish Civil War. But as we know, after World War II, he had no problem living in Spain under Franco, the last surviving fascist leader in Europe. And Franco remained in that position until the 1970s, which is always amazing, you know, that a dictator from the time of Hitler and World War II would remain in power in Europe until the 1970s. At one point, he made some sympathetic noises about Adolf Hitler. Of course, this was before World War II and the Holocaust and all that stuff. But Dali was Dalinian. That's what he said when he was asked, are you a Hitlerite or a Stalin adherent? He would say, no, I'm Dalinian. That's what I am. But he certainly understood the expediency of some of these political movements. And he made paintings. He made a painting about the disastrous Munich Accord between Chancellor Chamberlain of Great Britain and Hitler and Mussolini, which granted Hitler the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia and started the run down to World War II. So, and of course, there is the famous premonition of the Civil War that he painted, which is a huge painting, a very impressive painting with pieces of a human body all broken up. And it feels like a metaphor of Spain tearing itself apart. So he was certainly very sensitive to the social and political currents in his homeland. But then when you see when he goes to Paris, and even before at the Academy in Madrid, he starts to imbibe all of these modern movements, these isms, as he called it, you know, fauvism and pointillism and all these other, you know, currents that are pulsing through France. And of course, Dada and constructivism and cubism. And he samples them and discards them. You know, he tries them out and says, no, it's not really what I have in mind, but at least I've tried it. And out of that, then he creates a synthesis, which is his unique surrealist style. Chris, any other thoughts on that?
Actually, yes. And, you know, as part of being a scholar, you want to know everything about your artist that you could possibly know. So one of the first things I really wanted to see is just the progression of his artwork from, you know, when he was really young until older. So his first painting, of course, like most artists, is of a landscape. He's like 10 years old. He's painting landscapes. You can already tell as a 10-year-old, he has talent. He's capturing things and shadows and certain things that most 10-year-olds probably would not capture. And then he kind of transfers in the late 1910s to portraiture. And before you know it, he's being influenced a little bit by Picasso and Cubism. And I actually have one piece, which is a red chalk drawing of a Picasso Cubism piece. But as Jean-Pierre said, he goes through these isms very quickly, because before you know it, it's the late 20s and he's in surrealism. And it's really very interesting to see the progression from him being a 10-year-old and the skill level that he picks up through these isms. And where he really feels comfort is in that surrealism, realism period of time, but he really finalizes in classicism. And his later portraitures of certain individuals, and the most expensive painting he has had that's ever sold was about $25 million, was of Paul Éluard. And it's a beautiful portraiture of Éluard. I believe it was in mid-50s that he painted that. And his religious paintings are some of my favorites. But it's really very interesting to see the progression of his talents and the progression of his isms throughout his lifetime.
And, you know, that brings us to surrealism. And it's important, I think, to remember that surrealism was not necessarily an art style. such as Impressionism, for example, or Post-Impressionism. Surrealism was a state of mind, we would say today, you know. It was the idea that World War I and all of the havoc of the destruction of that war was brought about by an over-reliance on rationalism, on self-confidence, on the idea that civilization was standing at the pinnacle of its progress during the Victorian era. All that collapsed. And what André Breton said, what we need to do is not rationalize our art, but allow our innermost dreams, our visions, our impromptu thoughts to well up. And we need to capture that, because in there lies meaning that the rational mind cannot decode. And Breton calls it l'automatisme, the idea that things automatically come out of our subconscious and we need to capture it. And that should be the focus of our art. And the funny thing is that Dali does that in this first phase before World War II, as Chris said. But then after World War II, which is really a very convenient caesura in identifying the development of his art, after World War II, you see that he becomes far more deliberate. And now he starts to consciously, deliberately combine motifs in sort of a creative collage that combines mysticism with science in a vocabulary that really harks back to the best of 19th century realism. And that's what we try to describe in the book, the fascinating story of how that narrative arc, that creative arc was realized, is what ultimately produced Dali and these amazing paintings of such incredible realism.
And that's one thing that I've, you know, again, this is Dr. Brown. This is one thing that I've also always been a little disappointed in, because I think the general public, because of the handlebar mustache and because of the showmanship of what Dali had, they just attribute him to surrealism and this wild, crazy artist that paints these, you know, fantasy type of paintings. And that was only a small percentage of what he did. I mean, again, it was the classicism and these beautiful religious paintings and these other very insightful, calculated paintings that he took time to do studies on before he would even paint them. He just wasn't the guy to go up to the painting and start painting and all of a sudden, ooh, that's a Dali. That was rare. This guy was really calculated. He was really very advanced, and he used the most recent scientific discoveries, the most recent religious discoveries, and any new news item that would come out, he would grasp it and he would be the first to paint it or to display it in either a realistic way or in somewhat of a surrealistic way.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Dr. Christopher Heath Brown and Dr. Jean-Pierre Isabouts. Their book, The Dali Legacy, is out now. So tell us a bit about his classical influence. So you trace it, you talk a lot about the Renaissance artist's influence on him, but you also talk about 19th century realism. Which of those do you think is a stronger force?
Well, I think Chris and I looked at it very, very carefully, and you see that initially he's definitely driven by the traditional Renaissance artists, not only Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael, but he's very much inspired by the Spanish Baroque artists such as Velazquez and Melendez. You know, and the point we make is that something that's very difficult for us to understand today is the incredible impact that his first visit to the Prado Museum in Madrid made. At that time, art reproductions were black and white. They were either engravings or very primitive early photographic plates. You couldn't see an artwork in color unless you went to see the original. And for us, that's impossible to imagine because we're surrounded by all sorts of digital forms of facsimile, you know, screens, computer screens, television, whatever. And so you see that when he goes to Madrid and visits the Prado, he is absolutely astonished to see these works, and particularly the way in which Spanish masters handled texture, the difference between soft and hard, the texture of an apple or the texture of a piece of bread. That's what the Spanish Baroque artists excelled in, and that made a huge impact on him. But then as we go on through his academic, through his oeuvre, we see that he starts to become very reliant on the academic artists of the second half of the 19th century in France. They're also in Britain, but primarily in France, Bouguereau, Meissonier. These guys were able to create a canvas and you would swear it was a photograph, literally. Their control of light and dark, what we call chiaroscuro, their perspective, their atmosphere, it was just brilliant. Unfortunately, what happened after World War I and certainly after World War II, when both Hitler and Stalin embraced so-called social realism, which imitated that sense of very strong realism, in the West, in democratic states in the West, realism was utterly delegitimized because of that experience of World War II. Nobody wanted to do anything that looked like a realistic work because it reminded us of the totalitarian experience of World War II. And so everyone shifts to abstract art, all kinds of experiments, you know, here in America, abstract expressionism. And the essential contact between the public at large and artwork was disrupted. And Dalí gave himself the mission, the messianic mission, that's how he described it, to restore that link, to restore the idea that someone, just the average guy or gal off the street, could walk into a museum, see a Dalí, and be blown away. That's what he wanted to do. And to do that, he imitated, he very much strongly studied the art of that late 19th century, which otherwise was completely delegitimized in art historical literature. And Chris and I even discovered that he collected some of those works, but he didn't announce it because he knew the very pejorative association that was still attached to late classicist art. Today, that's changing. I mean, today there are, we're, you know, these works are coming back. You go to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, you can still see them. But let me tell you, when I was in graduate school in art history, nobody wanted to you know, you couldn't even refer to those paintings if you wanted to get a good grade. So you see how these things change. Chris, any thoughts on that?
Well, I will also say that, you know, we just don't write things and just make our own opinions and suppositions. We're relying on proofs as well. So, I mean, it's Dalí himself who basically makes a chart of all the old masters and the 19th century artists. And he puts Velázquez, Da Vinci, and Dalí all at the top. And other artists way low that he doesn't like. But for example, Velázquez, he gets like all nines and tens. And it could be a category like authentic, you know, work or colorway. So it would be certain things that he would grade each artist on, but Velázquez was his favorite, then Da Vinci, and then it's Dalí, just a half a point behind Da Vinci. So the other thing is, he also in the 70s does a suite of graphics called Changes in Great Masterpieces. So he picks a Raphael and Velázquez, two pieces of Velázquez and other masters. And so it was six different paintings. And he would do a minor modification in the middle of each of the paintings so that you would have to look at it and try to figure out what he changed, because he really wanted people to look at the art and he wanted people to understand the art. So, of course, he included himself in one of the changes of great masterpieces, and he made another persistence of memory and added a fourth clock, another clock in to the persistence of memory. So, again, these old masters were very influential to him, you know, after World War II, especially, but all the way until the end of his life. And I think he felt sorry for Michelangelo, because it wasn't until the late 70s and early 80s, all of a sudden, he paints a couple Michelangelo-like pieces.
Dalí's very postmodern. He's like Koons. He's very, you know, he's like Damien Hirst. He's just very in your face, very businesslike. Do you think he's changed the direction of commercial art?
Has Dalí changed the direction of modern art? Is that what you said?
Yeah, commercial. Has he made high art more commercial, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think that you know, Dalí anticipated many of the developments that we see in commercial art right now. The pop art phenomenon, for example, Dalí was way ahead of his time.
So in the museum in the States, you know, the Dalí Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, they really do show off his late masterworks, these things like the Ecumenical Council. There's another one, Dali Nude. They're just big, you know, they're like 20 feet tall, these things, and they're arranged, you know, the golden mean is all very is sort of clear, and there's so many symbols, and it's said that he took like, you know, it took like 2 years to plan each one. That was sort of, I think that was like high Dali. But at the same time, I think in the 70s, you know, he was being accused of signing blanks so people could print, you know, just make money off his art. Can you talk about that later?
Yeah, and I'm going to hand this over to Chris in a minute, because Chris is one of the most prolific and leading collectors of Dali graphics in the United States. And I would love, Chris, to talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like to collect Dali graphics. And he has got tremendous experience about that. So I'll hand it over to him in a minute. But yeah, these large canvases, again, is a reflection of the classicist artists of the late 19th century. They were called grand machines at the Paris Salon every year, the great machines. And there was almost a competition of how big you can make the canvas, you know, to have that awesome effect of literally being transported. That's a psychological term, being transported into that world. You're not looking at a painting, you're in the painting. And that's exactly what he was trying to achieve as a result of that. But Chris, why don't you talk a little bit about, if people want to collect Dali graphics like you have been doing so successfully, what are some of the things they should look out for?
That's a good question. But first, I want to come back for a second, though, because I don't want it to make it appear like Dali intentionally tried to promote a fake Dali world or market. What happened is he had one or two unscrupulous managers, and they would wait until the last minute where he was ready to leave Europe and come to the U.S., or when he was going to leave the U.S. and go back to Europe. And when you do a graphic collection, say you're going to do the 12 tribes of Israel, there might be 250 of the edition, but there's 12, you know, individual lithographs in each suite. So in order to do that, you know, if you take 12 times 250, that would be, you know, 400 or 500 pieces of paper that would need to be signed. And he basically had checked off the bona teres, or the final copies of the lithographs. And the agent would say, we're going to take this to print next week. I need you to sign 1,000 pieces of paper so that you don't have to come back to the U.S. and we can get this off to market. So two managers, one was in Europe, and the other one probably was more Europe than the U.S., had him sign at two different times 2,000 pieces of paper. And it was usually on Arches paper. And unfortunately, some of these unscrupulous managers kept those pieces of paper aside. They didn't use what it was supposed to be intended for, waited till Dali came back to Europe or America and had him do it again. Some of these fake pieces of paper or Arches paper were discovered when somebody was driving between one country and another. I think they were going from Spain to France, and they were discovered at the border, and those were confiscated. But because of these fake signed pieces of paper, in addition to people just signing Dali on Arches paper, Dali got a little bit of a bad rap, like every single other artist did. Renoir, Picasso, all these guys, Chagall, all have fakes out there. That he got a little bit of a bad rap for fake, some fakes. So we have some of the best certifiers in this country. In fact, Frank Hunter, who wrote our foreword, is a very good certifier. If you ever want to buy a Dali, whether it's to put over your couch or as an investment, then you could send photographs or the piece to Frank Hunter or to some of the other wonderful certifiers, Bernard Yule, Joe Nuzzulo. There's a number of really good guys who will give you their opinion on it being authentic.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Dr. Christopher Heath Brown and Dr. Jean-Pierre Isabouts. They were talking about their book, The Dali Legacy. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus via Zoom.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you so much, Joseph.
Thank you very much, Joseph.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Animal. silver stream can't tell them apart at all.
En el 90.7 FM y a través de la internet en kboo.fm.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7.